when I think of insulin secretion, I think of type 1, or way back the old nomenclature, juvenile. Or insulin action, also insulin resistance, possibly, probably. Or it can be a combination of both, so people can have both types. And that gets really more deeper into diagnostic categories. And so for our purposes, we don't necessarily need to worry about that. But as I said, there's newer nomenclature. It's changing. Right now, we think of type 1 diabetes as insulin dependent. So that's all those letters, I, D, D, M, insulin dependent. Non-insulin dependent is also known as type 2, or more frequently now, we hear it as adult onset. And I'm thinking, in my reading, as I recall, that the cutoff age is age 27. Have you guys talked about that in PEDS, the difference between women? That's what I'm thinking. It's like age 27. If you're under that age, if you're diagnosed, it's type 1, over type 2. However, there's always a yeah, but, you know, yeah, but. We are now seeing children with metabolic syndrome and obesity who are now being diagnosed with type 2. So don't worry about the age cutoff, because that doesn't apply to us. We also talk about pre-gestational diabetes, and that's in OB. Those are women who have diabetes prior to getting pregnant. So you may see that noted in prenatal records. And then, of course, GDM is gestational diabetes. And we'll talk about the diagnosis and the treatment of that today. However, in your book, there's a new classification system that's come out in the last few years. It's known as White's classification system, and I put the page there. It's much more detailed. Again, up on maternity, postpartum right now, I don't see those designations used, but if you went to work in high-risk OB or you worked in endocrinology, diabetic clinic, you may see that used. But I just want you to be familiar if you hear that term, White's classification system. And I would encourage you to just take a look at the table in your book. It basically talks about the severity of the diabetes and what's the treatment for it. And this new system, it talks about diabetes either with or without complications. So during pregnancy, did they experience related either, you know, vascular complications? And again, we'll go through those today too. And once in a while, we'll see diabetes that can be drug-induced. And can anyone think of what class of drugs might tip someone over into the category of being diabetic?
Is it the long-term steroids?
Could be steroids, yeah. So, and again, think about back to PEDS. You probably talked a lot about kids with asthma and respiratory, and what are they often treated with? Steroids. We're seeing more adults with adult onset asthma, and oftentimes they're treated with steroids. So, and I don't know for sure, but it seems like oftentimes back pain is treated with a course of steroids. And I don't know if that's increasing or the treatment is changing. I'm not a back pain expert, so. Okay, so right now, diabetes, probably around 10% of all pregnant women are affected. However, we also know there's a lot of undiagnosed diabetes in the United States. And we know that the rates are rising. And so again, pointing back to the importance of prenatal care. If a woman is not getting prenatal care or not being consistent with her prenatal care, she easily could have had gestational diabetes but not diagnosed. and again, we'll talk about some things in pregnant, previous pregnancies that lead us to think that way. Obviously, a patient with diabetes during pregnancy is considered high risk. She may do just fine, but we still consider her a high risk pregnancy. Ideally, we would all be able to see, our patients would all be able to see, a nutritionist, a diabetic specialist, but that's not reality. That doesn't often happen, and sometimes it just really falls back on you, the nurse, to help manage this. But basically, and I just said this a moment ago, so really what diabetes is it's a group of metabolic diseases, and it's characterized by, actually that should say hyperglycemia, not hyperinsulinemia, I can't even say that word this afternoon, resulting from, again, defects in insulin secretion, insulin action, or a combination of both. And what happens is the body will compensate for that inability to convert glucose into energy by burning muscle and fats. And that's why you see ketones spilled in the urine. Okay? Now, it's not uncommon for pregnant women to spill a little bit of ketones in their urine. Oftentimes, if you look at a UA, you might see a trace noted. We don't get too excited about that. But if it progresses to be, reported out by the lab, 1+, 2+, elevated blood sugar, then that's going to get our attention. But oftentimes, because of the normal alterations that occur with pregnancy, a lot of women will spill a little bit of either ketones or sugar. Okay. But we're going to talk first a little bit about type 2. So it's, again, a metabolic disorder where the body does not use insulin properly. So we talked about insulin resistance. And that's a problem, again, not just in pregnant women, but in many adults. And that oftentimes is what we'll see with someone who maybe has a family history of diabetes, or they've started, gaining more pounds in later life. And so that's kind of that first step, is they develop that insulin resistance. And hopefully, ideally, we catch everybody then, make some changes, and, avoid the full-blown development of diabetes. But what happens is the pancreas initially, with insulin resistance, will overproduce insulin. It's trying to compensate. So, like, a lot of systems in the body, we try to self-regulate, or the systems try to self-regulate. So initially the pancreas will try to produce more to make up for that. But again, it gets tired. It, in essence, burns out. The beta cells will. And with time, then the pancreas is unable to counteract the effects of the hyperglycemia. Now, that may be, you often will see adults, again, with type 2, where they're making some insulin on their own, but not enough, and they need extra medication to help them do it. I'm not really an expert on all the new diabetes meds. It just seems like every time you turn on TV, there's a new one being advertised. So, again, it's not something that I deal with a lot, because in OB, a lot of those meds won't work, or we can't use them because of the effects on the fetus, and we'll talk about what does work. But really, the point of all this is the key, or the optimal goal, remember we always talk about goals, is we want to keep strict control of their blood sugars, and we're going to talk about why that is so important. So in normal pregnancy, in all pregnant women, there are alterations in their whole metabolism, but especially in their glucose metabolism, insulin production, and just their whole metabolic homeostasis is altered. That's why we use a different set of normal values to diagnose gestational diabetes. I have those included in the slides later. But what we need to remember is glucose is the primary fuel for the fetus. So, you know, again, if mom is not taking in enough, yes, babies literally, I don't want to say they could starve to death, but certainly we see moms that don't eat well or poor socioeconomic, and they may have an infant who's small for gestational age. During pregnancy, they're diagnosed with intrauterine growth restriction. But usually what happens is whatever that baby needs, it takes from mom, nutritionally. So that's why oftentimes at certain periods in pregnancy, when there's periods of rapid growth, often during the second trimester, women will have these episodes where they feel dizzy, lightheaded, faint, sweaty. They're having a hypoglycemic episode. And, you know, everybody gets nervous when a pregnant woman is going to pass out, you know, so I always say, let's get her, you know, get her some food, get her something to eat. And oftentimes, patients during pregnancy will complain of feeling dizzy or lightheaded, oftentimes a headache, and that's the first thing you want to find out is, when did you last have something to eat? They may not have felt like they needed to eat, but sometimes that's the first symptom, is developing a headache or those other, you know, lightheaded symptoms. So remember, glucose crosses the placenta, but insulin does not. So the fetus usually starts producing their own insulin about 9 weeks. And we'll talk more about what this glucose crossing the placenta means. During the first trimester, again, that's the period when all the organ systems are developing. They're, you know, I think of it as laying down the groundwork. And so the insulin needs increase during the first trimester. But really what we say, when we talk about pregnancy as a whole, it has what's we know as, is a, now I'll try to say this word this afternoon, keep myself from being tongue-tied, diabetogenic. In other words, a lot of the normal hormones of pregnancy have an effect of helping increase blood sugar. So again, that's the reason why we use different normals to diagnose diabetes than we do in the general population. And so talking about that diabetogenic effect, you get progressive insulin resistance that occurs during pregnancy. That is a normal effect. However, women who develop gestational diabetes are at higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes later in life. And so again, when we discharge patients who've been diagnosed as a gestational diabetic, we need to remind them of that. And again, by the end of the semester, I feel like I've said, yeah, diet, we should always talk to patients about diet and exercise, but so many things we now know are influenced by that. Even our whole food supply and the foods we eat, some of them, well, many of them are not good for us, but we'll talk more about that. So a woman who's had gestational diabetes really should be advised that at least once a year she should have a fasting blood sugar check, particularly if she's had a family history of diabetes in her family or a previous pregnancy with diabetes, and then we'll talk about other risk factors too that we want to identify and really encourage those patients. But besides getting their blood sugar checked, it's also a good time to, again, remind them of the importance of, you know, exercise, eating the right combination of foods can really make a difference. But going back to pregnancy as an insulin-resistant state, it's really due because the hormones during pregnancy contribute to insulin resistance by blocking the insulin receptor sites in the muscle, fat, and liver of the mom. Okay. So that's, again, why we say pregnancy is a diabetogenic state. And this combination of hormones can actually decrease the effectiveness of insulin that she's making by about 65%. So again, if in a woman who does not develop gestational diabetes, her body can accommodate, but in a patient who has the right combination, the genetics, the risk factors, you can see that's a lot of risk to add on to that. And most women, again, we know that right now only about 10% of pregnancies are diagnosed as gestational diabetics. So that means about 90% of the other, you know, 85 to 90%, they're able to compensate because their body doubles the insulin production. Okay, so by 24 weeks of gestation, her pancreas has to secrete twice as much insulin as it did pre-pregnancy. So again, that's another reason we want her to be in a healthy state. I'm going to talk more about kind of pre-pregnancy planning in patients who are diabetic in just a bit. Now the last trimester, so those last 12 weeks, 13 weeks, is when there's really a lot of rapid fetal growth going. So again, you know, the first trimester, it's kind of like we're laying down the framework for everything. And then second trimester, life is good. But then that third trimester hits, and that's when the fetus should really be putting on weight, laying down muscle, fat, getting ready to, you know, be delivered and be healthy. So from about weeks 26 to 35, those insulin requirements may triple. And that's why managing gestational diabetics can be intense. Those are the patients you're gonna see more often. And if we have them on insulin, not all gestational diabetics are treated with insulin, but if they are, probably they're gonna be talking with the nurse or the diabetic educator frequently and making adjustments in their insulin. And also, these are the patients that should be checking their own blood sugars at home, probably at least four times a day. I've seen patients sometimes it's six or more. In a gestational diabetic, she cannot secrete enough extra insulin to overcome the insulin blocking effects of the placental hormones. Okay, so human placental, blah, 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 all of those, HPL and prolactin, remember? Prolactin is responsible for helping her body get ready to breastfeed. So many of the hormones that are beneficial for pregnancy can also be problematic or contribute to the development of gestational diabetes. And so what happens is this results in an elevated BS, is not what we all think of as BS, blood sugar, and the diagnosis of diabetes. Okay. So I mentioned earlier pre-gestational diabetes. These are patients who've already been diagnosed as diabetic, or sometimes when they've had gestational diabetes in a previous pregnancy, and then they come in with a subsequent pregnancy, the provider will treat them as if they are already diabetic. In other words, we really want to get on top of things. Honestly, when you look at all the diet plans in the world, boy, are there a lot of them. Really, if you think about it, probably eating a diabetic diet, which is what if we all ate that, we'd probably all be in just great health. And I'm going to put myself in that category too, because I do love chocolate. So, but the big thing is preconceptual counseling is huge with these patients. You really want to get that blood sugar under control prior to conception. Some of the maternal risks that we associate with gestational or diabetes as a whole is they're at an increased risk of infections, and we already know pregnant women are, because their immune system is naturally suppressed, so they don't reject for pregnancy. So now we've added just another risk factor. They also have an elevated risk of polyhydramnios. So if you guys, have we talked about that, polyhydramnios? What is it?
Excessive amniotic fluid in the uterus that leads to uterine distension and possible excess risk for postpartum hemorrhage.
Because you had a patient with it, didn't you? Yeah, see, that's why. But that's pretty good. Thank you for that definition. Yeah, so women with polyhydramnios, those are the women walking around and their friends will say, or strangers usually will say, aren't you about to have that baby? You know, you look like you're ready to pop. They can look full term and they may be 32 weeks. So we have polyhydramnios, excuse me, we'll talk in a later lecture about oligohydramnios, which is the opposite. There's not enough amniotic fluid, and that has implications also. Certainly they're at risk for, higher risk for ketoacidosis, and that affects mom and baby. They can be very prone to episodes of either hypo or hyperglycemia. Again, pregnancy can be a real roller coaster ride for diabetics. And it can be a real challenge for them to maintain that even blood sugar. It's those high swings in blood sugar in anyone who's a diabetic that really is associated with vascular damage to the microvasculature. So that is really the reason why in all diabetics we like to keep those blood sugars as evenly controlled as possible. And in fact, in the last, it's probably about 2 years, I saw that the internal medicine docs now have really tightened the upper limit for blood sugar and blood pressure both. Certainly because of polyhydramnios, risk to the fetus, maybe inability to control blood sugar, numerous factors. Moms with diabetes are at increased rate of C-section. And now think about it, we already know they're at an increased risk of infection, and they may not be able to keep their blood sugar stable, and now we're going to throw surgery into the mix. So you can begin to see it becomes very complex sometimes managing these patients. A lot of gestational diabetics also develop PIH. So, and they may even be diagnosed with preeclampsia. So our management gets very complex. Certainly because of oftentimes the large for gestational age baby, because really, if you think about gestational diabetic babies, Gary, on your patient, how large was her baby, do you remember?
I think it was normal for gestational age.
Okay. Anybody else think it has taken care of some diabetics in clinical, gestational diabetics?
Just last week, yeah. And their baby was fine.
Okay.
It was normal weight.
Okay. So probably, you know, again, you can't always say if it's this, it's that, and it equals, but oftentimes just infants of diabetic mothers, they're those large babies because, you know, they've been hanging out just soaking in sugar for 9 months. So they're often those really large for gestational age babies. You can also see small for gestational age babies, and I'll explain that in a bit. But the thing to remember is moms who go through pregnancy with diabetes, and again, this is not 100%, but they are at an increased risk for developing renal and kidney issues later in life. So it just escaped me, the movie with Julia Roberts. And she plays a gestational diabetic. Anybody seen that movie? Is it ringing some bells? Can you guys remember the name? Yeah, I can't either.
Steel Magnolias?
Steel Magnolias, thank you. See, now, I would have remembered that about 8 o'clock tonight. But in Steel Magnolias, that's exactly what happened, was she was a gestational diabetic. She was, an OB or a nursery nurse, too, on top of it. I know she was a nurse, but anyway. But the thing to remember about moms who have gestational diabetes is that they have a 50% increased chance of developing metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes later in life. So remember I said pregnancy is often, well, my clinical students have heard this, pregnancy is often a time when you're really motivated to change your behavior because you've got this new baby coming, you want to be the best mom ever, and oftentimes people will, you'll see them, like, quit smoking, not always, quit smoking or change their diet or decide to start exercising. This is a great time to capitalize on some of that motivation. Did you have a question?
You said increased risk for renal disease and what else later in life?
Type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome, okay. And, you know, if you remember back from med-surg, metabolic syndrome puts you at increased risk for heart disease. So, risks to the baby include, so IUFD is intrauterine fetal demise. That's why we see these patients more frequently. We manage them differently. I have taken care of diabetic moms whose babies died in utero. And I cannot tell you what a tragic event that is. It's very sad. There's an increased risk of congenital malformations, oftentimes cardiac. So again, if you get a baby in that you know mom was a diabetic, you're often going to see, you know, a lot of attention paid to, you know, are there murmurs? What's the color? You know, are there their blood pressure is normal, all those assessments we do to measure normal cardiac functioning in these infants. Oftentimes I've seen moms that have even had a fetal echocardiogram prior to delivery in utero to get prepared for that. You know, the thing about OB is we can't prevent all the complications, but what we like to do is know what we're dealing with, so that when time comes to deliver, we're prepared. We've got everybody on board. Or maybe she shouldn't even deliver here. Maybe she needs to go off to Denver or Salt Lake, somewhere like that. So that's really the purpose of getting all this information. And certainly these infants are at higher risk for hypoglycemia because, again, they've been hanging out and getting all that sugar with mom, and then they get delivered and suddenly that supply is cut off. And if they're not feeding well, these are the infants that can be at higher risk for hypoglycemia. So these are the babies you want to be watching. You know, how often are they feeding? How well are they feeding? Are they jittery? Are they having trouble maintaining their body temperature? Because we know that if you get cold, you start shivering, you use up more of your energy, your blood sugar can, you know, becomes that downhill spiral. So those are all the things that the nurse is thinking about when she gets these infants in. Okay, so talking about preconception counseling, it is associated with a much better outcome. And so really what that means is we'd like that patient to come in before she ever gets pregnant. She should be able to come in and show that ideally, you know, the last 3 months her blood sugars have been stellar, her med control is or compliance is great, she's aware of, you know, what her dietary needs are, she's getting exercise, you know, life would be beautiful. However, that doesn't happen. But if it does, this is also the time when these patients really should be screened for any underlying vascular conditions, which means a visit to the ophthalmologist for a retinal exam. A lot of young adults, there's no need to do that. But if she's diabetic and considering pregnancy, that really should be a baseline. Let's get a renal function panel and see what's her underlying renal state. Because again, pregnancy can be very stressful on her renal system. Certainly, does she have any underlying hypertension? What's her cardiac status? Again, we know that with advanced maternal age, all adults, as they age, are at higher risk for developing diabetes. And if she's advanced maternal age, she's at higher risk for hypertension and diabetes and, you know, a lot of issues. So that's really why it's nice to see these patients ahead of time. Ideally, her family would be included because diabetes, you know, if you live with a family, you don't usually, I'm going to say usually, eat meals by yourself. You know, it's a family event, hopefully. Oftentimes, exercise, I don't know about all of you, but I can tell you, I sold my exercise equipment at home because it was not motivating at all to go get on a treadmill by myself. It became a very elaborate closed storage device. So we sold it, got a membership at the Y, and there's something about when you have to be accountable to somebody else or you're being encouraged by somebody else. I don't know. I just feel like I do much better. So I sold all the exercise equipment and joined the Y. However, I always ask students this. So the best piece of exercise equipment I ever bought cost me $25. Any guesses what it is? I'm on my second one. Second one cost me more than $25.
Segway.
Segway. Any other guesses?
Dog.
Exercise.
It was my dog. Yeah, I adopted a homeless dog. And I'll tell you, that dog looks at me every morning like, are we going now? Get your shoes on. So anyway, there's actually been a lot of studies that have shown, especially as adults get older, if they own a dog, they're in much better shape. So I'm promoting dog adoption at some point. However, when you talk about, so we talk about diet, we talk about exercise. If insulin's going to be needed, certainly we want to do a good job of educating our patient on how to do that. How to check their own blood sugars at home. You know, it's really interesting right now. I wear my Fitbit. Some of you probably have Fitbits or Apple Watches or whatever device. And there's a lot of research going into, will they someday be able to monitor your blood sugar through your skin? Interestingly, I just read an article not long ago that there's also concerns the other way of how accurate will those be, will treatment decisions be based on it. Also, that information will be out in the world somewhere, you know, the whole cyber issues. So, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see in your time in healthcare if we'll all be walking around getting our blood sugar monitored that way. Certainly in pregnant women, you know, they're preconceptually, we're not going to talk about fetal surveillance. However, we need them to understand that when they get pregnant, the importance of early prenatal care and consistent prenatal care. Because really our goal is a healthy outcome. We also want to have an accurate EDD, estimated date of delivery. Due date. Remember, we talked about polyhydramnios, large for gestational age babies. That's why a due date needs to be accurate early on, so we're managing her well, hopefully controlling those factors and not bringing her in to deliver what we think is a large baby when really it's a smaller baby with polyhydramnios. That doesn't happen so much anymore because, as you've all seen, ultrasounds really become the standard. in every pregnant woman. Everyone gets at least one ultrasound during pregnancy. If they are diabetic, however, you will see those are the patients, sometimes they're having 4, 5, or 6 ultrasounds, especially the latter half of pregnancy, to monitor the pregnancy and also growth of the baby. I just put one website on there. I'm sure there are so many more, and I honestly haven't even looked, but I'm guessing probably there's lots of apps on your phone now to help you know, moms with gestational diabetes or diabetes during pregnancy to, you know, give them reminders, help them with management. So we talked about polyhydramnios. Gary told us what it was. It's actually 10 times more common in diabetic moms. So it's not uncommon to see a woman who is diabetic looking like she is really carrying a large baby. She may be, she may not be. It could be polyhydramnios. There's also higher rates of premature rupture of membranes, preterm labor, and postpartum hemorrhage in these patients. So again, there's a lot of risk factors that go along with being diabetic. There's higher rates of spontaneous abortion in women who are diabetics, and also higher rates of fetal demise. And I'll tell you a little bit about a patient that I took care of that had a demise. Ketoacidosis can occur during the second or third trimesters. And again, it can lead to intrauterine fetal demise because it can lead to hypoxia in the fetus. Okay. Or that ketoacidosis can put her into preterm labor. As I said earlier, it's not uncommon for pregnant women to develop some hypoglycemia during pregnancy. It doesn't usually have an effect on the baby. It's the mom who's going to feel it. So, and again, you know, years ago when I worked for one of the OB docs, he said to me, you know, when you take care of a pregnant woman, you really have two patients that you're caring for, but the second one, all you can do is take its pulse. True. You know, you measure fetal heart tones, but you really, you can't measure things. I mean, we could if we were in a high-risk OB unit, but we don't usually want to go poking big needles in uteruses and poking babies and doing things like that. So we often have to judge what's going on by what's going on with mom. Okay, so DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis in pregnant women, the range kind of tends to be 180 to 240 or anything above that. Okay, so again, remember I said oftentimes we use different lab values during pregnancy. There's an increased demand for insulin production in the second, third trimesters. So again, if she's a diabetic patient on insulin, she will probably be needing frequent dose adjustments. And that increased demand can, oops, I see I have a typo there, can cause insulin deficiency, and then that can cause hyperglycemia, and then she starts burning ketones for energy, okay? And you, often there's many causes for the onset of DKA. It can be in early pregnancy or even later pregnancy, hyperemesis. Some women do a lot of nausea and vomiting, not just early pregnancy, but sometimes through the whole pregnancy, or sometimes it shows up again at the end of their pregnancy. So that can be a cause. Sometimes they haven't been taking their insulin consistently. Or they have an insulin pump and it's malfunctioning. You may not always realize that. One of the nurses up on the unit, I think she's probably told some of you, she has an insulin pump. She hasn't had any children, but you know, she talks, I actually learned quite a bit from her about, you know, being a diabetic and using an insulin pump. Illness, so if she gets, you know, a GI upset or a flu bug or, you know, a viral something going around, again, their immune system is depressed. they're at higher risk, and now, you know, we've added another complication to this mix of things we're trying to manage. Or again, use of corticosteroids if she's having some preterm labor, or the use of terbutaline, which is another drug that can be used to stop contractions, or a combination of all of those can certainly lead her to developing this. We treat it obviously as a medical emergency. She's most likely going to be admitted. Probably in our setting in Billings, she'd be on labor and delivery. Usually the treatment is they're placed on an insulin drip. So again, it's important to remember ketones and lactic acid can cross the placenta, and that will impair fetal oxygenation, and that can lead to fetal electrolyte imbalance, which can lead to fetal arrhythmias and fetal demise. Again, if they've got vascular damage due to the diabetes, which can occur in the placenta, because remember how vascular the think about Sim Mom's placenta, how red and beefy it looks. It's a very vascular organ. So if they have uncontrolled diabetes or diabetes that's poorly controlled, they may already be getting vascular damage in that placenta. That can impair blood flow, oxygenation, decrease flow of nutrients, and those babies, that's why sometimes they'll be small for gestational age as opposed to large for gestational age. So really what I think about with diabetics is you got to expect just about anything when they come in. As I said, many times they sail through, they do just great, there's no complications, but we want to be prepared for the flip side of all of those. So remember ketosis, ketoacidosis is an insulin deficient state. And so IV fluids and IV insulin are the preferred treatment. Mom's blood glucose. So remember I said, you know, we work two patients, but we really, the second patient, all we can do is take its pulse. But we know that if we look at mom's blood glucose, we're probably seeing roughly equal with the fetus's blood glucose. Blood glucose. I need speech lessons, I guess. So the fetus starts making its own insulin around 9 weeks, and by 20 weeks, the fetal pancreas is fully formed and functional. So when that excess glucose from mom crosses the placenta, because remember, glucose from mom will cross the placenta, insulin from mom does not. So that extra glucose is just flowing in, that baby's fat, happy, and life is good. The fetus will produce excess insulin of its own to accommodate for that. However, think about then delivery happens and that supply is, you've got all that glucose on board. And sometimes then that supply is cut off, but they've still got that extra insulin production. That's why those babies can become hypoglycemic. So in these babies, all that extra glucose is converted to fat, and it's stored just like it is in, you know, adults around their abdomen, you know, their abdominal, and also their thoracic organs. And so that's the mechanism for seeing these macrosomic, which is greater than 8 pounds, 13 ounce babies. Usually we say 9 pounds. You know, if you're taking a history on someone and she has a history of 9-pound babies, that's the woman you want to find out, oh, gee, did you have gestational diabetes? Not every woman does. I always use my husband's family as an example. His mom had four children. The smallest was 8 pounds, like 8 pounds, 13 ounces, and the largest was 10 and a half. She just made big kids. So, but that's the definition of macrosomic imbalance. So when these moms come in, really laboring or for C-section, you know, most of our management hopefully has prevented any complications during the pregnancy. During delivery, probably don't do a lot of things differently, but certainly we're going to keep an eye on their blood sugar. You know, we want to have an IV in, ideally. We don't want her to get dehydrated, so, you know, we're going to be encouraging, you know, sips or, you know, fluids orally, but also, as I said, by IV. Certainly, if there's any concern that it's a macrosomic infant, most likely she'll either be scheduled for a C-section, or oftentimes gestational or diabetic women will be scheduled for an induction. That's actually an indication, a valid indication for an induction. And oftentimes they'll bring them in around 38, 39 weeks, instead of letting them go full term to 40 or even 41, because that's when those babies seem to really start putting on weight. So it's important to remember too that after delivery, in the first 24 hours, their insulin, mom's insulin requirements may totally just drop off. So especially if she was diagnosed as a gestational diabetic, her insulin, she may require a lot less. If they were a diabetic who was managed most with just diet alone, we don't even usually put them on any kind of special diet. They're just on a regular diet. They may not even have their blood sugars ordered to be checked. Because again, the first few days, just like a lot of things, those hormones are dropping rapidly, things are changing. And so often what you'll see is they're just managed symptomatically. In other words, if she's not having symptoms of high or low blood sugar, nobody gets too excited and pays any attention to it. Okay. But this is the biggie. They are high risk of postpartum hemorrhage because if they've got a large for gestational age or polyhydramnios. So again, that overstretching of the uterus. Like I said, always think about it. You know, think about rubber bands or those little balloons. You know, the first time you blow them up, you know, how they're really hard to get them to stretch, but then you keep working it and working it. So again, if you've got someone who's a multipara, history of diabetes, advanced maternal age, you know, you begin to think of all these risk factors, and already it's like your management strategy should be appearing for you. Okay, so let's finish up diabetes and then we'll take a little stretch break. So again, I already told you about the percentage of pregnancies. Women who are considered obese prior to conception and develop gestational diabetes during their pregnancy, their increased risk of delivering an infant with CNS defects. Okay. So again, going back to the whole thing of preconceptual counseling, we know that giving women folic acid can help decrease the rate of CNS problems, such as spina bifida, and another condition, anencephaly. So ideally, during preconception, that's another thing we'll have to do, is start taking that folic acid, or just start taking even a multivitamin every day, or a prenatal vitamin every day. We do know all women should be screened for gestational diabetes at 24 to 28 weeks. But a hemoglobin A1C, which you see used in adults to look back at their glucose control, we don't use that in pregnancy. It's not considered a reliable indicator because red blood cells are turning over more rapidly in pregnancy, and so we can't get a good measure. So we don't worry too much about a hemoglobin A1C. Years ago, this has nothing to do with diabetes, but one of my patients went in for like a health screen at her workplace, and one of the things they checked her for was cholesterol, and her cholesterol was, you know, off the charts. And she called up and she was concerned, and I thought, oh, okay. So I went and asked the doc, and he said, oh, just tell her baby's gonna have a heart attack, which he was joking. But things in pregnancy are not always reliable, so that cholesterol's another one we don't get too concerned about. So in terms of risk to infants, I know I talked a little bit about this, but infant outcomes are strongly related to the level of mom's glucose control prior to pregnancy. So again, it's really why ideally see them for preconception, we get everything, you know, whipped into shape. We just know that they're gonna have a better outcome. So, stillbirth in gestational diabetics seems to often occur around 36 weeks. And so these are the patients that oftentimes, instead of seeing them, you know, there's sort of this standard schedule of up to about 28 weeks. They just come in once a month, and they come in every 2 weeks. And then the last 4 weeks, they start coming in every week. Well, with diabetic patients, you may be seeing them like twice a week from maybe week 20 on, and perhaps the last month or even 6 weeks, those are the patients that are often coming in possibly two or even three times a week. We're trying to monitor them very closely, catch any potential complications early. About anywhere from 30 to 50% of the babies that do have the mothers who experience a perinatal loss, about 30 to 50% of it is probably due to a congenital malformation. Most often, I think of it as a cardiac thing. We talked about macrosomia. Here it's 9.9 pounds. My other slide was 8. But, you know, it depends on the source you look at. But really, if you just think of any baby over 9 pounds, is considered macrosomic. They have increased rates of respiratory distress syndrome. So oftentimes these are the infants that can end up in NICU, or perhaps 24 hours after delivery, they've been staying in the room with mom and mom calls in and his baby's experiencing some symptoms. So again, you just want to be alert to that. I don't think I need to read all those other complications that can occur, but shoulder dystocia is a big concern with diabetic mothers because, again, macrosomic infants. So again, we don't really want to get into that situation with a bad shoulder dystocia. That's oftentimes why they will be induced early or even scheduled for a C-section. So really, I think of diabetics, you've got to look at all the potential complications and really choose the less of all the evils. And so maybe, yeah, surgery is a risk, but maybe that's a lower risk than letting her go full term and delivering a large for gestational age infant, bad shoulder dystocia, tearing for mom, et cetera. So it's really a balancing act. Gestational diabetic infants may have delayed fetal, oh, it should say lung, not leg. Believe me, your pitch. Lung maturation. So again, that's why these babies are having poor fetal distress. I updated these slides just over the weekend. I've gotten some new information from the nursing, the review courses for nursing certification that A1 provides. So I was trying to update my slides. I guess I got a little too quick on my typing. And again, these babies are increased risk for hypoglycemia. But we also know that infants born to diabetic mothers, even if the infants themselves are of normal size, or if they're large for gestational age, they are at higher risk for developing diabetes themselves later in life. We know that they're at higher risk for diabetes and heart disease and another group of, you know, a whole host of illnesses. So again, it's really, you know, to me, OB really is kind of a whole circle. And this is a good example, is if we get her in good control preconceptually before she's ever pregnant, we manage her well throughout pregnancy, hopefully with a good outcome, and we can, you know, affect some lifestyle change habits, it's better. But there is that out there. There's that increased risk for childhood obesity, which is another reason, I'm going to tell you, why we'd like these moms to breastfeed. So I talked about this a little bit earlier. You know, I tended to repeat myself in these slides, so hopefully I'm not confusing people too much. But again, the degree of glycemic control before delivery or before pregnancy really speaks to the outcome. So again, hemoglobin A1C will be good before she's pregnant. But it's not used once she's pregnant. That's when we're going to be looking at her blood sugars that she's checking. As I said, renal and eye exams, they certainly should have those done. Ideally, all patients would get to have a dietary consult with a dietitian or a diabetes educator. Probably some of you maybe got some interest in being a diabetes educator in the future. I think you will not lack for work, sadly, or I guess that's a good thing because I think nurses can do a lot of good education. Exercise, really important. You know, even if it's just walking every day. And I think that's a lot of times where nurses can really be encouraging and helpful. Patients often look at what nurses do, especially in OB, because they're, you know, oftentimes you're their peer. So even if it's just taking a 15-minute walk a day, that's better than not going at all. And so a lot of times I think as a nurse, you know, instead of just saying, you know, you should exercise 3 times a day, you know, just say, hey, what do you like to do, you know? Oh, could you, you know, walk for 10 minutes on your lunch hour or things like that? I think that really helps when they hear it from their nurse. So in terms of actual treatment, as I said, they may be treated with insulin, but oftentimes they're treated either with metformin or glyburide. Those are the two drugs that are safe to use. As I said, a lot of these newer ones, not used. Now that may come, you know, 10 years down the road when we've had time to do more analysis and testing, etc. Again, monitoring their blood glucose levels, and I cannot speak enough to how much follow-up and teaching by the nurse. A lot of times patients know, oh, they have to call in their blood sugars to the nurse. I'm a big believer, if you got to be accountable to somebody else, aren't you more likely to follow through? I know that's true for so many things. If I say, I'm going to exercise, I'll be there tomorrow morning, and I know that someone's expecting me to be there. You know, I'll drag myself out and get there. So I think, you know, really what we are is we're not necessarily their friends, but we're their partner in this if they know that we want a successful outcome with them. So some other things, again, she's at greater risk for DKA and infections. As I said, she's 20 to 30% more likely to develop PIH or to already have hypertension. And we'll be talking about PIH in the next week or so. As I said, These are the patients that oftentimes will you'll be seeing them for more frequent ultrasounds. Or later in pregnancy, we do what's known as a biophysical profile, and that's the BPP. So biophysical profile is a specialized, really what it is it's an ultrasound that's done in the office along with a non-stress test. So we basically do an ultrasound, she's given a score, it looks at fetal movement, fetal breathing movements, amount of amniotic fluid, etc. But also we just put her on the monitor for about 20 minutes to just see, is she having any contractions? Is baby responding to those contractions? So that's really a biophysical profile. As I said, they may be sent in for fetal echoes to look at the heart structure of the infant. And then daily fetal kit counts. Sometimes moms are asked to do this, and really all that is she's asked to pick a time during the day when she has a pattern of when she knows her baby will be active. And all pregnant women develop, they kind of know, like, talk to someone who will say, yep, every night from 2 to 3 a.m. that kid was awake because he was kicking my bladder. So, but oftentimes it's after lunch or in the morning. And what we ask the mom to do is lie down for one full hour and count the number of movements she feels in 1 hour. Kind of the standard for the general thinking is if she feels 10 or more, kicks, moves, whatever, great. If it's less than 10 or if the pattern changes, then she needs to call her doctor's office. That can be an early indicator that perhaps things are changing and perhaps it's time to get more aggressive either in our management or consider delivery. We talked about all this, so I'm just going to skip over that stuff. So again, postpartum care. As I said, in the first 24 hours, insulin requirements can decrease because we've taken the placenta out. We're not getting those placental hormones that can cause an elevation in her blood sugars. Okay? She may not even require insulin for 1 to 3 days after she delivers. Or if she was simply on metformin or glyburide during pregnancy, they may not even order that and may just see how she does symptomatically. It can take several days for her body to reaccommodate carbohydrate metabolism and stasis. So again, you know, we just want her eating well, eating frequently. As I said, there are higher risk for PIH, hemorrhage, infection, but these are the moms we really want to encourage them to breastfeed. And we used to say, oh no, if you're diabetic, you shouldn't breastfeed. And I don't know why we said that. Now we want them to, because when milk production begins, it takes, burns a lot of calories to make milk. And it takes a lot of sugar to make that milk. So that's actually a good thing. We really would like all these moms breastfeeding. In fact, even in moms who are not diabetic, oftentimes they'll tell you that when they delivered and breastfed their baby, they just dropped the weight lickety-split. So, and again, provide information about family planning, mostly because we would like her to space out her pregnancies. We would like all women to have plenty of time to recover from pregnancy, to allow their body to recover to a pre-pregnant state, but especially in these moms, especially if they have some complications. Or perhaps it's appropriate that, you know, and that's a discussion her provider may have with her, that maybe future pregnancies are not advised for her. Let's see, we talked a little bit about this stuff. Oh, who's at higher risk for developing gestational diabetes? Any woman who's over the age of 25. So that's really pretty young. Anyone with a history of obesity, or is obese herself, I should say. Any family history of diabetes. Previous large for gestational age, polyhydramnios. Any woman who's had an unexplained fetal demise. It may be an undiagnosed diabetes. History of spontaneous abortions. Sometimes it's diabetes that hasn't been diagnosed. Or a mom that has a baby with numerous congenital anomalies. Okay, so how do we diagnose it? Well, you all know everybody should have a glucose screen at 24 to 28 weeks, like a 1 hour glucose. If that's greater than 130, again, we lowered it. We used to say 140, now we say 130. They should have a 3 hour glucose tolerance test done. If two of the four values are elevated, and it can be any two, then that is our criteria to call her a gestational diabetic. Okay? So it doesn't matter if it's the fasting and the 2 hour or the 1 hour and the 3 hour, those are all looked at. Diet's the main treatment, as I said, exercise, glucose monitoring. Only about 20% of patients actually have to go on insulin. And the best diet is the one with the low GI index. So in other words, stay away from, you know, white flour, white sugar, carbs, although carbs are not all bad. So I want to be clear about that. Really, one of the healthier diets around is the Mediterranean diet, or, you know, lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. I always say fiber is our friend, whole grains, certainly lots of fluids. Any of these healthier diets, they're associated with a decreased need for insulin and a lower birth weight. Yes?
Are those glucose tolerance testing, are those levels like fasting or 2 hour or?
Well, the glucose tolerance test, they'll go in and they draw fasting blood sugar, and then they give her 100 grams of that really sickly sweet, like it's like orange pop that nobody likes, I can tell you. And then they'll draw their blood and get a value of 1 hour, 2 hour, and 3 hours. So that's a glucose tolerance test. We use different values, and they're, you know, every lab will give those to you. So that's why I don't expect you to memorize those, because Billings Clinic might calibrate their machines one way, St. V's might be another. But so the lab will give you a report and tell you what the norms are for each. And then if any two of those four are elevated, that's when technically it's a diagnosis of gestational diabetes. So when you talk about a euglycemic state, I did put the norms there for you. So fasting, usually around 60 to 95 before meals, 1 hour after a meal. And again, I talked about the role of the nurse. I think I've stated that. But really what we're trying to do is prevent complications, both for mom and for baby. Infants of diabetic mothers, I've talked about that. But please note, women with vascular complications are more likely to have that small for gestational age. So oftentimes, you may see a gestational diabetic with PIH. So again, as a nurse, I'm really going to be watching for complications from this baby. I think I've stated all that enough. So let's give you guys a quick stretch break, and then we'll come back and finish up a few other things.
But she forgot. I'm going to break because I'm so thirsty when she was talking about it. We'll finish this song, then we'll do a break. Right. We never got one. It's like, oh God.
I
This race has 2 weeks. I feel so unprepared for school. Got my calculator on Tuesday. Got my pencils today.
Oh, well. Yeah, that's why.
Teresa, for gestational moms, yeah. They usually do a hard counting, right, for their meals, for nutrition.
Yeah, I think so.
Because that's what they taught me before, and that's what my friend just learned.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be worried about sugars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's what we like. I'm sure they told me about grains.
Yeah.
As opposed to, there used to be that Dr. Cobb or whatever he called it, just go flour sugar diet. You know, tremendous amounts of weight. And that was really the premise of the Atkins diet, was people didn't eat any carbs. And so they thought they'd drop their weight right away.
Oh,
most of us aren't being able to sustain it.
My friend is doing it. She's got blood sugars are momentarily low.
Are they?
Same pattern, sorry, talking about carbs.
Okay,
so
that's
which
good.
Is, it's good, but they're like 50s. So.
Yeah, well, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, they really have pulled it.
Yeah.
A lot of things. So, something
because of the rare class.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
I just put up here a little scenario. This was actually a patient from a few years ago. And I didn't touch on this in lecture like I should have, but we know that certain ethnic groups also are at high risk for developing diabetes. So Native Americans, African Americans, Hispanic populations, and Pacific Islanders, so like Samoans, whatever all those islands are. Those ethnic groups can be at higher risk for developing diabetes. So again, we always talk about, you know, any disease process, what are the modifiable risk factors and the non-modifiable, and certainly that's one of them. So anyway, this is a patient that came in and she had gestational diabetes. And I think prior to getting pregnancy, her hemoglobin A1C was 5.2, but she came in and she was being treated with diet, insulin, glyburide, and I think they had her on an insulin drip. Anyway, she had a history herself of a PDA repair, so patent ductus. And at the time she came in, so she's Native American and a smoker, but also had a gum abscess. Okay. And she, do you know what a DINCA is? A DINCA patient? Did not keep appointment. You love all the acronyms we always come up with. So she was supposed to see the specialist, the maternal fetal medicine specialist, but didn't follow up on that appointment. But did tell the nurses that she had a family history of cardiac disease, hypertension, and COPD. And also had a history of postpartum hemorrhage and had a C-section previously for a breech delivery. So this patient was a gravid of 5, term 2, AV2, and only living 2. So she was coming in to have her third baby. And she gained 24 pounds during her pregnancy, and this was, oh, and by the way, it was twins. I think it might have even been undiagnosed twins. And she delivered at 36 weeks, and the babies were sent to NICU. So, what would be your top three priorities for this patient? Yeah, so first off, yeah, bleeding. What are some others?
Really poor healing.
Okay.
Infection.
Yeah. She had a lot going on. By the way, it is extremely important that women who are pregnant do get good dental care. In fact, at our, I might have said this to you guys earlier, our fall faculty meeting, someone is doing some research on putting the mouth back in the body, which I thought, okay. But really what's happened is so often oral health doesn't get addressed by primary providers. It kind of gets turfed off to dentists. But unfortunately, a lot of patients don't have dental insurance, can't afford it, and so there's really getting to be a more awareness of what can primary care do. Well, some of the things, you know, again, we can be encouraging good diet, and good oral hygiene, and some of the stuff that we don't always think of. Okay, anyway, that was just an example of a challenging patient. So we're gonna switch gears a little bit and talk about some other conditions you don't see as much, but certainly it happens, and one of them is hyperemesis gravidarum, which translates, that is Latin for I am pregnant and I am throwing up too much. So it doesn't happen real often. Nausea and vomiting occurs in about 70% of all pregnant women. And usually about 12 weeks, it resolves on its own. Life is good again. You know, she's able to start eating more regular meals, that sort of thing. But occasionally it happens where it doesn't stop. Okay? So basically the definition, besides my attempt at humor of a Latin term, is it's nausea and vomiting that's severe enough to cause 5% weight loss. And when I was an OB office nurse, you know, patients would call up and say, oh, I've been vomiting all day. I can't keep anything down. Okay. And that may be true, you know, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't treat those patients. But the absolute diagnosis of hyperemesis is those are the patients I want to bring them in and I want to weigh them and see are they actually losing some weight. And probably some of you, if you look at your patient charts, occasionally you'll see someone that comes in for their first prenatal visit and maybe they're real early, 6 weeks, and by, you know, the next visit they may have even lost a few pounds if they've had a lot of nausea and vomiting. But hyperemesis, it'll usually kick in around 10 weeks of pregnancy. As you can see, it's not real common. It's only about 3 or 4 pregnancies out of 1,000. Now the good news about hyperemesis is you can pretty much assure the patient you're not going to miscarry because they have a lot of hormones on board that are maintaining things. So that's sometimes hard for moms, you know, if they're vomiting and vomiting and vomiting and they're losing weight and they feel horrible. That's often their first fear, is that they're going to, you know, cause harm to their baby. But again, babies often, or fetuses, will get what they need first, and mom will feel the effects. So it's associated with first-time pregnancies or women who have a obesity by definition, but also women with a history of migraines. And I always find that interesting. Actually, there's sort of this, there's some women who have migraines as adults. They developed car sickness as kids, and then they get hyperemesis as adults. So there's some thinking that all three of those are hormonally connected. I see a few people like, oh yeah, thinking, oh no, I was car sick as a kid, I'm doomed. But not always. It's also associated with multiple pregnancies. So again, it's that level of pregnancy hormones. Or a hydatiform mole. Remember, a hydatiform mole is a pregnancy that has begun normally, but then the development is arrested. And it just becomes like this blob of cells. It's often described as looking like a cluster of grapes. Hydatiform moles are not viable pregnancies, but they can be associated with a lot of nausea and vomiting. And as I said, they have a decreased risk of spontaneous abortion. So the symptoms, certainly that 5% weight loss, if she's vomiting enough, she can develop dehydration, hypotension, tachycardia, and actually an electrolyte imbalance, which of course can lead to cardiac arrhythmias. So these are the patients that usually the best treatment is you bring them in and you give them some IV fluids. Again, hyperemesis and nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, it can become this vicious cycle. She starts vomiting, and sometimes, you know, she feels like if she eats something, she might feel better, but then it just comes back up, or she's trying to drink fluids, and they just come back up. It just gets worse and worse. So oftentimes, and this is true of anybody with severe nausea and vomiting, you just make them NPO, put an IV in, give them a liter or two of fluid, and oftentimes that in itself will take care of the nausea and vomiting. Likewise, in pregnancy, sometimes the best thing, and this is just for women with nausea and vomiting of pregnancy or nausea, is if they eat something before they ever even get out of bed in the morning. I've actually known women that keep crackers or something right by their bed, and if they eat something the minute they wake up and kind of graze all day long and don't let their stomach get empty, it will help with that nausea and vomiting. As I said, IV fluids, and that might be all they need. If not, sometimes we treat them with Zofran or one of the other anti-emetic drugs. Dietary advice. So, you know, pregnancy is kind of this weird time in women's life, and some of you, if you've been pregnant or you've had friends or relatives that are pregnant, they'll tell you all these weird stories of how they suddenly wanted to eat one thing or another, or couldn't eat one thing or another, or sometimes just seeing things. I know when I had my first child, I could not walk by the meat counter in the grocery store. Suddenly all that, those packages of red meat with like, so that you can't explain. You just go with it. So. And certainly any noxious stimuli that induce nausea. So for pregnant women, sometimes it smells. I had a friend that, now I don't think about this a whole lot, but she couldn't lick a wooden spoon. You know, she'd cook, and if she licked a wooden spoon, there was something about that that made her feel nauseated. I don't know. Stay away from the wooden spoons, I guess. But as I said, they may just need IV fluids, and that'll take care of it, or some of the anti-emetic drugs. Again, you want to really look at the weight loss. It's got to be that 5%. It doesn't mean if it's not 5%, we don't say, well, too bad for you, just go home. We would still treat them, but this is to meet the criteria for a diagnosis of hyperemesis. Certainly, you're going to look at their CBC, their UA, their electrolytes, possibly liver enzymes, bilirubin. There may be some underlying GI stuff going on. Women get gallbladder problems in pregnancy. Women get, you know, stomach flus in pregnancy. It sometimes can be associated with hyperthyroidism. So you may need to look at deeper and rule out an underlying disorder. Yeah, so some of the other things that work really well is taking a vitamin B6 vitamin with a Unisom, which is really just a Benadryl. We'll take care of it. Or sometimes just plain vitamin B6, they can take anywhere from like 50 to 200 milligrams a day, can help. Or, as I said, some of the other drugs, old drugs, Reglan, Anivir, usually it's Zofran. if none of those drugs works, sometimes treating them with corticosteroids does. And we don't know why, but it has helped. And I have seen a couple patients that were treated with that. Sometimes it can be related to anxiety. And so, again, it would be appropriate to have that patient get a psychosocial assessment, see if there's some underlying things going on. Okay, so I alluded to hyperthyroidism. So basically that is an overactive thyroid. It's an overdrive. And that occurs in maybe 1 to 2 out of 1,000 pregnancies. We don't see it real often. Just as in, you know, general population, we tend to see more hypothyroidism than hyper, but it can happen. So some of the symptoms is tachycardia, heat intolerance, emotional lability, possibly weight loss, and severe nausea and vomiting. I've now just described all those symptoms that can be associated with pregnancy. So it may be difficult to diagnose. In the last probably 3 to 4 years, I've seen now that an initial TSH is now included in all the prenatal lab workup. That did not used to be the standard of care. But one of the signs that we often associate with hyperthyroidism is exophthalmos, so those people that look like their eyes are really wide open. You know, and I always joke, you always know you're a nurse because when you're kind of bored and you're scoping the room and kind of people watching, you know, you're either looking at, oh, who has good veins to start an IV, or sometimes when I see people with those real large eyes, I think, oh, I wonder if they have their thyroid. But I don't go up and ask them. I don't know that they'd appreciate that. Or a goiter, so an enlarged thyroid, which is why, you know, you learn physical assessment, how to palpate someone's thyroid. On their labs, if you do a thyroid profile, they'll have an elevated T3 and T4 with a decreased TSH. Because remember, TSH is what drives the thyroid. And if that thyroid gland's on overdrive or it's overactive, it doesn't need as much TSH. So if you see those very low, then that's the patient you may suspect of hyperthyroidism. And the drug of choice is PTU, which is, this is one long word I can say really well, propylthiouracil. Now don't ask me why I can say that one really good and others I can't, but that's why we call it PTU. The other treatment for hyperthyroidism, of course, is to radiate the thyroid gland and basically kill it, and then the patient is treated with thyroid hormones for the remainder of their life. However, we don't want to be radiating pregnant women, so we don't do that during pregnancy. Not a good plan. Okay, so the flip side is hypothyroidism, which I said, we tend to see that more commonly. And oftentimes, these patients are also the same ones that can't even get pregnant because they can have really irregular menstrual cycle, they may have a lot of bleeding problems, they just can't get pregnant. And we're gonna talk about infertility, you know, later in this semester, but I often used to say that was always kind of the easy fix for infertility, because oftentimes if you diagnosed it as hypothyroidism and got that corrected, their cycles would correct and they'd go on to be able to deliver or get pregnant and deliver a normal baby. But women who are hypothyroid are at an increased risk of having a spontaneous abortion. So again, if they come in and they already have that as an underlying diagnosis, being a good nurse giving all that information, you know, I don't want to alarm the patient, but I just want to let her know, if you notice any bleeding in pregnancy, you know, be sure to give us a call. Okay. We can't always prevent an SAB, but if it's due to too low of thyroid hormone, you know, maybe she's going to need some adjustments. And you will see women that are treated with Synthroid or any of the other thyroid medications during pregnancy, instead of having it checked, you know, once a year and maybe getting their dosage evaluated once a year, during pregnancy, again, that time of rapid change, rapid metabolic change, they may require more frequent dosage changes even during pregnancy. If it's untreated, so again, no prenatal care, she doesn't know, she's at higher risk for PIH and placental abruption and stillbirth. So I think that was probably part of the reason to include it as part of the prenatal profile and identify it early on. It's caused by glandular, I can't say certain words, that's one of them, glandular destruction by autoantibodies. And the drug of choice is levothyroxine. And again, it's a little more common, maybe 2 to 3 pregnancies out of 1,000. Although it seems like, and I was talking to some of the nurses up on the unit, seems like a lot of nurses have hypothyroidism. I don't know if it's because of our shift work or things we're exposed to. I don't know. So anybody who's going to go to grad school, there's your future research topic. See if that's true. It's just something we're observing right now.
Teacher, is there?
Yeah.
For like the 1 to 2 out of 1,000 for hyperthyroidism and the 2 to 3 out of 1,000 for hypo, are we referring to those who develop it during pregnancy?
No, they have it beforehand.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We don't usually, I mean, I've never seen anyone develop those during pregnancy. These are women that have that prior to getting pregnant. So the big things to remember, takeaway points. Every woman should be screened for gestational diabetes at 24 to 28 weeks with a 1-hour glucose test. You know, it's cheap, it's fairly easy, and it's so important to the outcome. Any patient who has a 1-hour glucose of 130 or greater should be sent for a 3-hour glucose test. And if any 2 of those 4 values are elevated, that is the criteria to diagnose gestational diabetes. And remember, they're at higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes later on in life. And most of gestational diabetics are managed with diet and exercise. They may be on metformin or glyburide, or occasionally they're going to be on insulin. But really, the most important thing about gestational diabetes is we really want tight control of that blood sugar, because it will lead to a greater likelihood of a full-term pregnancy, a healthy fetus, and less complications for mom, either during or post-pregnancy. So the patient I'll tell you about, she came to see us, this was many years ago now. She had been a type 1 diabetic since childhood, like age 6 or 7. And I happen to know her mother, so that's how I know some things that I might not have known otherwise. She was never real compliant. You know, you think about kids and teenagers and trying to get them to do all that stuff. Yeah, she wasn't real good about it. But she got married and went to see a provider. She did go see her regular doctor. Now, her blood sugars were not in good control, but he said, you're young. Yeah, go ahead, get pregnant. So she did, pretty easily. So she moved here. At the time, I think her husband was in the military. So she came here about mid-pregnancy. and started seeing coming to the practice where I worked. And so the doc that I worked for at the time did manage high-risk pregnancies. So right away, he did the appropriate thing. He sent her off for an eye exam, and he sent her off for a renal eval. And lo and behold, she already had changes. She already had retinal changes, and her kidney function was already altered. And by the way, she still wasn't very compliant with her blood sugars. You know, honestly, her mother said this to me, and I would agree. She was very ornery. She just, you know, she was gonna do her thing. So we did the best we could. Well, then her pregnancy kept on, and she, her husband got transferred, I think, so she went to be with him. Anyway, delivered her baby, I believe, around 36, 37 weeks, and by then had developed full-blown renal failure. And sadly, her baby did not live. It had congenital malformations. Her baby did not live. And so now she was on dialysis, getting dialysis twice a week, went in for one of the runs 1 week for dialysis, and she herself had a full cardiac arrest and died. And you know, what a tragic situation and tragic story. And honestly, I don't tell you this story in the terms of I want to point fingers and blame, but again, I think it points back to, I just wonder if we'd had that good control of her glucose and better management, might have her outcome been different? Certainly, we'll never know. But, you know, that was just a really tragic situation. So, in Steel Magnolias, I'm going to give you the spoiler because I doubt if anybody's going to go and watch the movie. But that's actually what happens in that movie. She does not survive. She has pretty significant diabetes. And although it's an incredible movie, you still should watch it. Pretty cool film. But Julia Roberts did not make it to the end. So again, back to our takeaway points. We wanted to recheck thyroid levels probably more frequently during pregnancy. The patient may need more frequent alterations in her dosage of medication. And with that, I think we'll skip this because I can see people are drifting off. I'm gonna let you guys look at those. So, thank you very much. Any questions about anything before everybody hits the door?
Yes. How old was she when she
went
in
for
full renal failure?
Oh, she was young. She was in her 20s. Yeah. I mean, it had been a lifetime.
No,
not being controlled. So.